Okay, that's us on now.
Good evening, everyone. This is David Noble in Dalgety Bay in Fife, and tonight joined as ever by John Johnson, who I believe will be at home in Glasgow this evening. I've got a very interesting 45 minutes ahead. I'm delighted to welcome to the show this evening Professor Tony Townsend, who is Chair of Public Service and Educational Leadership and Management at the University of Glasgow. What I would like, I suppose, to start off with in a moment is just to ask Tony to say a little bit more about his work in education. I'm very kind of humbled to have a read over Tony's CV, and it's incredibly impressive, and particularly the extent of international work that Tony's been involved in. Just before I ask Tony to introduce himself, as ever, we try to make Radio EduTalk as interactive as possible. So if you're listening to the live stream, you can make a comment or send a question into the show for Professor Townsend just by typing a comment on Twitter and including the hashtag EduTalk. You can also follow Radio EduTalk by following at EduTalker, that's EduTalkr. And you can send a message to the show by that particular means, but the best way is just to use the hashtag EduTalk. If you're not a fan of Twitter, if you don't use Twitter, you can also send an email to the show during the live broadcast or at any time. And the email address is edutalker, again, edutalk with the letter R at the end, at hotmail.co.uk. So, Professor Townsend, if you'd like to maybe just speak a bit about your career in education, that would be great.
Thank you, David, and thank you very much for inviting me to talk to you tonight. As you can tell, I'm not from this part of the world. I started off by working in Australia for most of my career, and over the last 8 years, we've been doing my, what I call, around-the-world tour. I spent 5.5 years in Florida and found out how the warm people live, so I decided I'd go to Scotland for a couple of years to see how the other side lives. So I've travelled a fair bit, and a lot of my work takes me to various parts of the world. I've been very fortunate. I've worked in probably about 45 countries now in various ways. So what I'd like to talk to you about tonight is some of the things that I've learned in my travels, and particularly those things that may be of interest to teachers and may be interest to parents as well.
That's fantastic, Tony. And I know that the lead up to tonight's show, we spoke about possibly, in addition to you talking about various aspects of education, you've kind of gleaned or become an expert in across your long career in education, that we might also focus on the power of positive questioning for teachers. So just before you you start your talk, Tony, I'll just again encourage listeners to the live stream to get in touch via Twitter or by email. And if you're listening to the recorded show, then of course you can go to edutalk.cc and leave further comments or questions at a time that suits you, and I'm sure Professor Townsend will be delighted to have them passed on to him in due course. So I believe Tony, and we may have a break or two in the middle where we can maybe pause and reflect and see if any listeners have got comments or questions for you. But the floor or the ether is yours now, Tony. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Well, I guess I would like to start, when we're talking about the power of positive questioning, is that all of us are teachers in one way or the other that are listening to this broadcast. And I'd like to ask you a question, first of all, and that question is, what is the one place in school where learning happens? Now, I've asked this question all over the world, and people have come up with various things in the classroom, behind the shelf, the shed, all of those different things, but there is only one place in school where learning actually occurs, and that's in the head. Unless we actually move things into the student's head, it hasn't been learned. And so we have all sorts of ways in which we need to look at things that are associated with learning in order to be working properly as teachers. Mahatma Gandhi said at one stage, "No child fails to learn from school." But unfortunately, we know, and this is true in many parts of the world, that there's some of the things that children learn from school are the things we don't want them to learn. And some of the things that we'd really like them to learn, they don't actually listen to, and they don't listen to us. So what I'd like to talk about tonight is the whole notion of learning and how the use of questioning, and certainly appropriate questions, is very important if we want students to learn well. And I want to start by referring to some research. There's been a lot of research on learning, and some of it is pretty important, but the most important thing that we find is that most of the learning that students do happens in classrooms. And there's learning that comes out of Australia, there's learning that comes out of America, research that comes out of New Zealand, and it all says the same thing. Essentially, if we really want to look at learning, there are three or four things that we have to think about. The first one is, how do we manage our classroom? And that is, how do we manage the curriculum? And how do we manage our teaching? How do we manage the relationships that we have with our students? And what sort of teaching styles do we have? The second one is thinking. And it's what students think about, but it's also how they think. And how they think is pretty much universal. I think thinking is something that happens in adults, in students, in babies, and the actual process of thinking is identical for all people. The difference is determining what students are thinking about at the time when we're asking them to think. And that's the second thing. And the third thing are the relationships that we establish between the students and ourselves. And so John Hattie out of New Zealand made the comment one time that when it comes about student learning, it is what teachers know, do, and care about, which is very powerful in your learning equation. He did some research in the early 2000s, and what he found was about 50% of how much student learns comes from the students themselves. So it's their background, it's their families, it's their communities, it's how they feel about themselves, it's how they feel about learning. But then if we look at the other 50%, about two-thirds of that 50%, 30% of it, comes from teachers. So teachers are incredibly important when it comes to student learning. Far more important than principals, far more important than parents, far more important than other students in the grade. So it's the relationship between teachers and students that I really want to focus on. And what we need to really think about is how we establish these three. If we're looking at classroom management, it's the curriculum and how we present it. And it's the classroom and how we manage it and the relationships that we establish. If we're looking at thinking, it's the ability of the student to think, which I've already said is universal, but also to decide what they think about. And that's something that each student has the power to do. It's not us that does that, it's the student. And the third thing that we need to look at is the relationships. Now, it's interesting because when I talk about student learning and adult learning being much the same sort of thing, if we think about all forms of learning, there are really three different components that we need to consider. And so if we're thinking of having a relationship or having a talk with somebody else, the first component is the task, what it is that we're talking about, or what it is that we have to learn, or what it is that we want to do. And there are two different ends to these things. The first part of the task might be individual pieces of knowledge, individual tasks to do or so on, very specific things, just little bits of information. And at the other end, there are the processes that we use to understand the world, or it's the concepts that we have of the world, both of which are very incredibly important, and I'll come back to those in a minute. So if we're looking at the task of schools, the task is essentially what we might call a curriculum. And of course here we have the curriculum for excellence. So what we need to think about is how do we look at the curriculum for excellence, and how important is it in terms of all of the things that we do? Are we looking at very specific pieces of information, or are we looking at development of whole people, enabling all young people to become those four different things? Successful learners, confident individuals, responsible citizens, and effective contributors. Now, if we're going to do that, we need to go beyond individual tasks. We need to go beyond just looking at certain types of things that students can memorise and then ask them to answer the questions. So that's the task element. The second element is essentially a power relationship. It's a relationship that we have with other people, and we're always in a circumstance of there being two or three different opportunities. One person can be in a powerful relationship to the other person. They can both be in a fairly equal relationship, and it's these relationships that determine how we look at the world. So again, if we're learning, we can think about the power. At one end, we have one person in charge of others, and it's essentially that person telling other people what to do, telling other people how to do things. If we have a much more even relationship where the power is much more evenly spread between the people, then it's likely that we will have two things occurring: asking questions and then dialogue about answers. So at one end we have telling, at the other end we have asking. And that's what I want to focus on mostly a little bit later on. So essentially, if we're looking at the relationships within classrooms and within schools, there are six different relationships that we need to think about. The first relationship is the student to themselves. We need to have students with a positive relationship with themselves, and to do this, they need to be asking themselves positive questions. And this is what I want to talk about in a few minutes' time. The second thing we need to have is a relationship between the student and learning. There is no necessary relationship between the student and learning. Students don't always see themselves as good learners, and we need to build their understanding that they are. Thirdly, we need to build the relationship between the student and the content, the information that we're trying to get across. Now, sometimes we, as teachers, have the impression that everything we talk about is of supreme interest to students, but it's not. We have to build that relationship to fractions, to homework, to a whole series of other things. In order to do this, we need to consider the other relationships that are human relationships: the relationship between the student and the teacher, the relationship between the students and the other students, and the relationship to the student and the broader community, which includes parents, neighbours, friends, other people outside of the school. So if we look at these things, we then need to start to think about what is the third element. And the third element is the environment in which we work. And this environment can either be supportive or it can be oppressive. It can be congratulatory or celebratory, or it can be punitive. And if you think about it, we have people at all of these different ends of the spectrum. A good teacher will spend some of their time using each of these things. But if we have teachers using certain things all the time, then the student responses are going to become habitual. Students are going to respond to us in the way in which we treat them. So if we spend all of our time telling students what to do, if we focus on very minimal things, so very individual tasks and facts, and if we do it in an environment that is negative to the student, then the student is going to be resistant to learning under those circumstances. And in fact, if we think about it, if you are told what to do, if you get punished if you do it wrong, and if it's an individual fact, then all you have to do is memorize the answer and everything is okay. It keeps everybody happy. We have to ask ourselves the question, how much of what we do in our classrooms really relies upon the student simply memorizing something rather than doing something else? There are a whole series of other things that you can have by mixing up those three different dimensions. I want to go to the other end. And the other end is a focus on building students' concepts or building their understanding of the processes and things. So if we take mathematics, for instance, we can look at the processes involved in addition, or we can look at a simple 2 plus 2. They're different levels of understanding. Now, if the teacher is asking questions that is associated with developing processes, and the teacher is supporting the students in their understanding, then the outcome for that will be understanding the process, the concept, what it is that they need to do. Now, I might take a little break there to see if there's any slight information that you want me to update, or if there's any input from other people. And then what I want to look at is the brain research and how the brain research actually helps us to understand how these things work.
That's great, Tony. I just checked Twitter. I don't think we have any comments at the moment, and I'm not looking for an answer necessarily at this stage in your talk, Tony, but I'm interested in you've referred to the Scottish Curriculum for Excellence, and you seem to be kind of building the argument that it's important to emphasise processes and a variety of processes to develop an understanding of concepts. And I think maybe later on I would be looking for you to possibly critique the extent to which the way the Curriculum for Excellence is written, I'm sure it aspires to these kind of outcomes, but the extent to which the way it's written, the language of the experiences and outcomes actually suggests that we might get to a point in the future, or it expects learners to develop a variety of processes and to understand deep concepts right across the curriculum. So I'll leave that. I hope that made sense, and I'll leave that at the moment and just let you continue.
Okay, well, I want to now just look at the brain research, and it's very interesting how much we've learned about the brain in the last 20 years. And essentially what we have learned is a fair bit about learning. It's interesting, we used to have the right brain and the left brain material, and now people are starting to say, no, it doesn't work that way. We don't use the right brain for certain things and the left brain for certain things. We use both sides of the brain to do all different things, but it's a different sort of understanding. But I want to spend a couple of minutes that look pretty specifically at what learning is. Now, learning, if you really want to get down to the tin tacks, is simply a connection between electrical and chemical transmission. That's all it is. The brain has electrical transmissions in the cells, in the nerve cells, and it has chemical transmissions between the nerve cells. So when you get to one end of one nerve cell, there is a gap, and it's called the synaptic gap. And the way in which information flows across that gap is a chemical exchange. So when we put bad things into our body, it actually impacts on that chemical exchange at that point. So if we don't have enough fluids, if we put various types of drugs or alcohol into our body, it doesn't affect the speed of the electricity because nothing does that. So your thinking is just as fast within the cell, but the time it takes to go from one cell to the next one is definitely a disadvantage. So the process of thinking is that all of our cells are connected, and consequently, all of our concepts are connected. We have concepts of all sorts, but they're all connected. And they're connected by these cells and by the process of thinking. So, for instance, if I mention three words, and it could be three words at random, you will be able to organize these words so you can put them in a sentence. And it doesn't matter what the three words are. So if I mention football, water, and school, you will be able to organize those words into a sentence. You won't all have the same one, but you'll all be able to have one. And what's happened is that the process of thinking the electrical transmission and the chemical transmission has organized thinking. And what happens is the more you think something, there is something called the myelin sheath that builds up on each of the nerve cells. And they're like pillows. So every time you think something, a little bit more of this myelin sheath builds up. And it's electrostatically charged. And what this means is that at the moment, the electricity will take a certain amount of time to move from one end of cell to the other. But with myelin sheath, it goes quicker. So the more you think something, the faster you think it. To give you an example, if you think of the first time you tried to tie your shoelaces, very, very slow process. But the more you tied them, the more you thought about what to do and how to do it, the quicker you became at knowing how to do it. And so what this is doing is that the sheath is building up along the axon, the nerve cell terminal, the cable that joins the cell body to the terminal, and you think quicker. So what we have now is an understanding of how our concepts develop. So our concepts of anything are a series of connected cells, connected nerve cells that all end up in the same place. And so our concepts are developed. And any time we think about something, such as dog, school, bicycle, love, family, then we add a little bit more to that concept. And what I want to talk about is how these concepts are developed by the way in which we interact with each other. Just as we've got what we might call habitual behavior when we do things physically, so tying our shoelaces is habitual. Getting up in the morning and getting dressed is a habit that we develop. We do it so that our brain can be thinking of two or three other things at the time when we're putting on our trousers. I would almost guarantee that when you're putting on your pants, you would put your left foot in first all of the time. Or alternatively, you put your right foot in first all of the time. You don't change. It's a habit. But habits can not only be habits in terms of doing things like playing golf or riding bicycles. We have habits that become emotionally attached. So we habitually respond emotionally to things that annoy us. We habitually respond emotionally to things that we enjoy. And of course, student behavior is associated with the emotions that they're having when they're thinking about various things. So if we're scared, we will respond. Our behavior will act in a particular way. If we're angry, our behavior reflects that emotion. So what we need to remember as teachers is that the concepts that we have not only have a knowledge base, but they also have an emotional base. To give you an example, if you mention the word family to some people, they will get a warm and fuzzy feeling because family is their place of safety. But if you mention the word family to a child that has been habitually abused by their parents, they will not have a warm and positive feeling about the term family. They will have a different concept of family. Now the reason that I'm talking about these concepts and the emotional situations that are associated with them is that there are some pretty important concepts that are associated with what we do at school. What we have and what every student has is a concept of school, teacher, student, what a student is, learning. They have a concept of their own future. They have a concept of themselves. And now what I want to talk about is a piece of research that a colleague and a friend of mine from Australia and I did. I think it's still just as important. We went into some schools in Australia and we asked students what is your concept of school, teacher, learning, and so on? At the same time, we ask their teachers, are these students good learners or poor learners? What we found is that students who were poor learners all had similar concepts of school, teacher, and so on to other poor learners. Students who were good learners all had similar concepts to other good learners, but they were a totally different set. There were also some students in the middle that had some concepts of one and a different concept of others, and that was their own personal experience of what was happening over a period of time. So if we have students who have a negative concept of school, a negative concept of learning, a negative concept of teacher, then it is very difficult for them to learn. So we have, in pretty much every school in every country of the world, two groups of students entering every morning. One group of students is going to a place that they like, to work with people that they enjoy working with, other teachers and other students, to do something that they think is worthwhile for a future that is going to be positive. They see themselves as a learner and they see themselves as being successful. On the other hand, there's a group of students who go into the same place, the same school, the same classroom on the same day. They're going to a place that they hate. They're going to work with people that they think hate them. They're going to do something that they don't think exists. They don't think learning exists. And they're going to have a future that's not very successful. Their future is bleak. Now we have to ask ourselves the question, if we think of those two groups of students, which of these students are going to be good learners and which of these students are going to be poor learners? And it's pretty obvious that the more positive we feel about ourselves, and the more positive we feel about our understanding of what a school is, of what a teacher is, of what learning is, then the better we will do, the more likely we're going to be able to work through those things. I'll take another little break.
Thanks, Tony. I'm still not seeing much from outside, but a few things that have sprung in my being. But this, obviously, most folk that have taught have met the folk we're talking about, the children, both that are good learners and not so good learners. And I suppose that the simple question is, how do we give the experiences to the not so good learners to shift them? And a sort of by the by, probably off the wall idea was this idea of building up some sort of fast nerve thing so that your mind follows patterns easily, so that you can tie your shoes well or whatever. Is there a danger then that you can get trapped into a particular style of thought that stops you learning, that, and even people that are good learners will only learn the particular ways they have, and sometimes we need to think out of the box to learn, to move ourselves on. I probably not thinking too much about pupils at the moment, but just even myself.
Well, I agree with everything that you've said, that in fact there are particular ways of thinking and particular things that we think about that do stop us from learning. Now remember when I said, when I talked about those three different things, that the middle one was thinking, and it wasn't how we think, which is universal, but it was what we think about. And what I want to talk about now is the colleague that I mentioned before that I did this research is a person called Randall Clinch. And Randall Clinch has worked in Australia with people who really, really struggle to learn. And they have struggled in lives, and they've struggled in school, and they've struggled in their workplaces and so on. And he suggests that part of this is because people have not learned the skill of deciding what questions to ask themselves. and deciding what answers they will give themselves. In other words, his argument is that we can choose our thoughts, but we choose our thoughts based on the questions that we ask ourselves. So we have two different things that we need to work about. What Randall talks about in terms of teachers is that there are two types of teachers. He calls them the askers and the tellers. Now, probably all of us have had some of both in our experience. The tellers are teachers who tell you what to do, who tell you how to do it. If they see you struggling, they will come to your table, they will stand next to you and show you how to do it. And if you still can't get the right answer, they tell you what the answer is. And there are other groups of teachers who spend all of their time asking questions, checking to find out whether the student is happy with what we're doing, checking to find out if the student understands what they're doing, and checking to find out how we can extend what we're doing. So two types of teachers, askers and tellers. Now remember, we have a society that lives this way as well. We are told what to do for most of our lives. We have our parents that did it, most of them. We have our teachers that did it. And by the end, we get used to being told what to do and simply complying. So when governments tell us what to do, we simply say, okay. We don't question along the way. And yet, if a lot of the things that we're asked to do are negative, or things that we don't want to do, but we still have to do them anyway, we get a negative opinion and a negative emotion that is associated with that thing. And if you just think about how you respond in two different ways. If I tell you to do something, or if I ask you a question. Generally speaking, when you are told to do something, there is almost an immediate reaction to try and find out, how can I get out of this? How can I do it in the minimal way? How can I not do it at all? However, if I ask you a question, our brain automatically responds. So, what colour is an elephant? You may all answer in a different way, but I guarantee that pretty much everybody answered that question as soon as I asked. Because our brain responds to questions much better than it responds to orders, to instructions. And of course, a lot of what we do as teachers is instruction, and we need to start thinking about a different way of doing things. So what are the concepts that I think we need to build? The concepts that we need to build for students, there is a whole series of other concepts if we're talking about people who are working or not working, if we're talking about people who are addicted in some way, if we're talking about families and so on, there's a whole series of other concepts. But I'm focusing specifically on school. The concept of learning. The concept of teacher. The concept of school. The concept of self. And the concept of future. Now, each of those is critical to our understanding of what we do at school. We need to identify that these concepts can be pretty simple things. So the concept of learning is something I can do today that I couldn't do yesterday. The concept of teacher is someone who helps me learn. The concept of school is somewhere where we learn. The concept of self is I am a learner. And the concept of future is that it's something that hasn't happened, but I'm looking forward to it. Now, if we can build these concepts in all of the students that we're working with, then we have a pretty good understanding that if they really believe those concepts, then they will improve. Now, it's interesting that we can do this using questions. Questions get it going. They engage the intellect. If you put a scribble on the board and you say to the students, what does this mean for you? And if you ask your students to answer that question, you might get 20 different answers from 20 different students. But the next question is much more important. Who is right? And the answer is, we all are. Because if we ask people questions about their feelings, their impressions, their perceptions, then they are always right. Now, we did some work with some small schools in South Australia, and we decided that there were various things that were associated with the emotions that happened at different times. There were different times when we think about things. If you think of something that is coming, you have anticipation. You get excited about something that's coming if you enjoy it. So if you're going to a birthday party on Saturday, you get excited about thinking about that. If you think about something that you're doing that is positive, then you enjoy it. You enjoy doing things that you like doing. If you do them well, you feel rewarded. You feel good about yourself because you've done it well. And if you feel that you've actually helped somebody else or helped yourself in a positive way, you also feel satisfied. So what we did in this particular class was to have the students ask each other questions. It wasn't the teacher that asked the questions, it was the students asking each other. What did you enjoy about that class? What rewarded you? What satisfied you? And there was one other one that we asked. What did you contribute to that class? Now, if you think at the end of every lesson that you have, so a mathematics lesson, Johnny and Billy sit down and Billy asks Johnny, what did you enjoy, what rewarded you, what satisfied you, what did you contribute? And then Billy asks Johnny the same questions. What we're doing is we're actually myelinating the process. We're making brain connections to the concepts of enjoyment and lesson, reward and lesson, or reward and mathematics, or reward and English. So we're talking about building those pathways in the brain from the concept of enjoyment, where all of the brain cells come together for the concept of enjoyment. And we're making a pathway from there to school, to teacher, to learning, and so on. Now, David, you mentioned about children who might say that they can't learn, that they have difficulty learning. It's very simple to prove, just by using a couple of really, really targeted questions, to demonstrate that all children can learn. Simple questions. What are you good at? Now, they might not be very good at anything associated with school, but they might be good at swimming. They might be good at skateboarding. They might be good at putting music together on the computer. What are you good at? First question. We're focusing people's attention on what they're good at, and they're good at it because they enjoy doing it. So we're focusing on enjoyment, activity and enjoyment. The second question is, how did you get to be good at it? And they might say, well, I did this, and then I did that, and then I tried it again, and I didn't get it right the first time, but I was really interested in finding out, so I did it again. And then the third question is, isn't that learning? We've demonstrated that the way in which we get good at something is by learning it. So the real problem that happens in classrooms is not that students can't learn, it's because they don't want to learn this. And perhaps we're doing that because we're asking them the wrong question. And so we did in South Australia for this very small group of children was to see if we could develop this in their parents as well. So we asked the students for homework to go home and ask their mother and father, brothers and sisters, whoever they were living with, just one question. And they had to ask the question each day for a week, and they had to write down the answers. And the question was this: what did you enjoy today? Now, if you're a parent and you have your child come home and say that to you today, you may not be able to answer. You may have had a pretty bad day. But if you knew your child was going to come home tomorrow and ask that question, I would think you'd look for an answer. And just asking that simple question of the family actually changed the dynamics of what happened in the family. Because people would spend time over the dinner table talking to each other about what they enjoyed doing today. And then it became, what could you enjoy doing something tomorrow? What are you doing tomorrow that you might enjoy? And so on. So the questions that we ask are incredibly important. Changing one word makes all the difference. We also need to ask ourselves some questions. If we're looking to improve the work of students, we need to ask ourselves, how are we doing as teachers? What are we doing well? What are the things that we've done today that have been really successful, and how can we duplicate that tomorrow? We need to ask, who isn't learning? And then we need to ask, why aren't they learning? And then the last question is, what questions can I ask them to start making them learning? So I think what I'm talking about here is that the way in which we use questions is very, very important. Now, all teachers use questions. But questions like, have you done your homework, is not really all that helpful. Because the outcome for the student, however they answer the question, is not going to be good unless they've actually done it. And of course, you already know which students have done their homework and which ones haven't. So the first student says, well, I did it, but my dog ate it. And you know that's a lie. And so he gets into trouble for telling a lie. And the other answer is a truthful answer: I didn't do it. And he gets into trouble for not doing it. So that question leads to a negative outcome, whatever the response is, when you already know the answer. You need to come up with another question that might help students to be positive about homework and to be positive about what you're asking. So I've squeezed a whole lot into a very short time. There's obviously a lot more of unpacking all of these individual pieces in this. Randall Clinch in Australia has done a huge amount of work, and he is able to work with about two-thirds of the students he works with, and these are students that everybody else has given up on, have been able to improve what they do by him teaching them that I can ask myself questions, I have the power to ask myself questions, and if I ask myself the right question, I can view things much more positively when I'm in class.
Tony, I'm aware that we only have a few moments left. I certainly, as a classroom teacher, a classroom teacher of 16 years, it's been tremendous listening to you drawing in your own work and research from elsewhere. I don't know if John's got any final questions. I have one or two, but I know it's quite tight towards the end. But I will just say, if anybody listening to the live stream would like to make a comment or ask a question of Professor Tony Townsend, then please just use the hashtag EduTalk in your post on Twitter, and the email address, if you get in quickly, is edutalker, that's edutalker@hotmail.co.uk. Tony, I've just got one question, and apologies if it's not an area of your reading or your research. A couple of times during your talk I've been thinking about you know, the explosion of what may be termed online learning, and how that online learning does maybe occasionally happen within the school day. And I'm also thinking about, you know, who is the teacher in that case, or is there a teacher? Is there a fellow student? You've talked a lot about the undeniable existence of emotions within learning, and you've kind of touched on the kind of social side of things as well. So are there implications if we go down the route of more online learning, or assuming that online learning can be as deep, if you want to use that metaphor, are there implications where there may not be a teacher, where there may not be other students, to where there may not be as many and as complex relationships and dialogue as within quite a confined space as a classroom?
I think that why students probably enjoy online learning is, it, when I talk about those three things, the tasks might be the same, but they are in the powerful position because they control their learning. They're in a position of being able to do something. They don't get it right the first time. They can do it again until they get it right, and so on. Sometimes we don't give young people enough time to get good at what we want them to be good at. We have to move on. And I guess this is one of the problems when we have things like a very crowded curriculum. We can't afford the time to make sure everybody in the class gets good at this or that. We have to move on and do something else. Why? Because we've got tests coming up at the end of the year, and it has to be across all of these subjects. It can't just be on one. Now, what we do know is that students all learn in different ways, at different times of the day, and in different speeds. And what the online learning does is allow students to do that. So what we need to do as teachers is to become much more aware of students' learning styles. We need to become much more aware of when students, and it, unfortunately, this is one of the complexities of classrooms, is that students learn at different times. It's not all, let's do it all in the morning and let's have rests in the afternoon, because some people are not very good in the morning because they've been up late at night or whatever, but they pick up in the afternoon. So it's not an easy question. That's why teaching is such a difficult task. But teaching is still going to be central in what we do, because we learn better when we're with other people than we do by ourselves. When we're able to ask other people questions and get other opinions, and to be able to interact with the knowledge in between the two of us, or the three of us, or the 20 of us. It's this dialogue that becomes incredibly important in our learning. The more we talk with other people, the more we learn. So teaching is always going to be a very important part of what we do as learners. But what we need to recognise is that the technology is now available to us in many, many and much more powerful ways. And we have to learn to use the technology, to be ahead of the technology, to know what the technology enables us to do, so that we can find out that, you know, young Billy, that is not very good at reading, when it comes to reading the reader, is perfectly capable of going online and working on Facebook and communicating extremely well with everybody else. We need to come up with a much broader range of what it is that we understand as education and learning. Unfortunately, we have governments around the world that is now trying to squeeze that down very narrowly rather than broaden it out.
It's quite interesting that as I'm listening to you, I'm actually getting answers to questions that form in my head as you go. There's a couple of things I'm thinking when you're talking here. One is the business between ask and tell. Now, I'm not full-time in the classroom anymore, but I always felt when I was that I would start with ask as my mode. I would probably get into it. Then something would happen due to pressures of getting stuff done. And I would end up telling. And it kind of thinking about these, the children that need to be moved on from this negative attitude into the positive attitude, the difficulty seems to me to do that while you're meeting the requirements of the curriculum, of the school, of society's expectations. And I wonder, when you started talking about children just taking that simple question home, does that sort of run alongside sort of a normal classroom operation and sort of starts to address and bring some of these guys on side?
Then as a teacher, what we can do is at the end of every day, we can actually stand at the door when the kids are going out of the classroom and say, what did you enjoy today? Yeah. And if we ask it every day, they will find an answer. And it may well be that the starting answers might be, well, I really enjoyed my time out at lunch. I was playing football and really enjoyed that. That's fine. What we're doing is trying to find moments of real enjoyment that young people have associated with the school, associated with people called teachers, associated with learning. And it's always easier to tell because we're very practiced at it. And in fact, one of the things that is a real issue when we've tried to talk about this with teachers is that teachers have to unlearn everything that they've been trained, because they've been trained to tell students how to do things and then manage what happens. We talk about classroom management. We don't talk about classroom dialogue. And maybe if we really think about learning, we have to start again. We have to really look at how do we really learn. We now know much more about that than we did ever before. When I went to school, everybody learned by doing your four times tables. That was it. That was how you learned. You memorised things and you got the answer right. Now, that was useful, but only up to a certain point. It's when we ask ourselves questions that we really challenge ourselves. And if you think about it, as an adult, all of the things that you research, all of the things that you try to find out, just out of interest, have started with a question.
Yeah.
I wonder what that's like. And I think if we can get students to ask themselves questions about, I wonder what bedtime is like. What does it mean to me? What does it mean to you? Does it mean the same thing? I wonder what the term Islam means. Does it mean the same thing to everybody? Now, if you ask that question to an Islamic person and ask that question of somebody else, you get two different answers. But it's that dialogue that occurs in answering that question that actually helps both learn. The Islamic person learns about some of the things that other people see them as being, but the other person sees the Islamic person as being something totally different to what they thought they were. And it's through dialogue. If we had dialogue on an international basis, there wouldn't be any need for wars. We'd use football games instead.
And the other thing that struck me, you're talking about, or David asked the question about the online learning. This year I've started, I think, about three different online courses, and a couple of them are really interesting because they're sort of social. And
right.
you basically publish all your work, and then other people on the course comment, talk about it, and some of the comments are obviously, that's great and stuff, but there's people coming in and actually asking questions, and it feels quite different to me than an awful lot of other learning experiences I've had, because there's that space to talk, not to just to the instructors or the teachers, but talk to the community of learners.
And also, I think the other thing is that the outcome is not as defined as what it is in school. In schools, we have very, very defined outcomes. We want students to be able to read at this level. We want them to be able to perform at this level in a whole series of things. When you're thinking as an adult and you're working as an adult, you hope to learn about something. You don't have an outcome that is necessarily specified. And I think that narrowing of things down in terms of learning actually prevents a lot of our young people from being interested in what they're doing, because I know at the end there has to be a right answer here, and if I can't remember the right answer, I'm marked as being wrong. And we have to say to ourselves, how many times as a student, if you're doing a mathematics test and you get 3 out of 10, how many times does it take me? I can't be bothered doing this anymore. I'm no good at it. Are we asking the wrong questions of our students? Are we asking them things that separate them rather than bring them together? That isolate them rather than have them work as groups? And I think that questioning is one way in which we do it. We might all have a different opinion about what colour an elephant is, but having a conversation about that question allows us to see a whole different viewpoint of the world. We need to remember from a perceptual point of view that every single person sees every single thing differently. There's the old story of the car accident that occurred, and there were four people standing on four different corners and they all said different things. The four police reports of the four eyewitnesses were totally different. And of course they would be. For one car it was coming straight on, for another person it was coming from the right, for another one was coming from the left. And so you saw different things. We need to recognise that when we look at things, it's our emotional state, it's our history, it's our experiences that are looking through our eyes. And so somebody that is very, very experienced in, you know, in triage, for instance, will walk into the hospital, will see the patient and know immediately what to do. Somebody like me would walk into the hospital and throw up. Because of the different experiences. It's the same thing out there, but it's completely different reality inside every one of us. And we need to recognise that that's true for students. They all see schools as being a different thing. It's not the one concept. Mm-hmm. And what we're doing is by allowing dialogue, we're allowing people to start communicating with each other so that we understand each other's points of view. And that's really critical. I've gone on.
Gentlemen, I'm so sorry to have to bring the show to a close, and I'm well aware that we've actually gone beyond our time, and I really appreciate Professor Townsend actually using up the full hour. It has been very interesting, and I'd have to say yet another show that I'll be listening to again once it gets up online at edutalk.cc. So thank you very much, Tony, for your time, and also for all the numerous emails going back and forward to make tonight possible, and your commitment to realising this. It's still early days for Radio EduTalk, the word's spreading around, and there's many people within Scotland who are starting to have a look at the website and see how this might assist their work with young people through a whole variety of talks and a range of topics over the first half of this year. So thank you so much for offering to get involved at such an early stage, and it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm aware that I don't know what we call it, John, the fuzz of doom's about to come upon us.
A minute and a half, I think.
Cheaper radio station. So I'd just like to thank... those listeners who are listening to live streaming who access this recording. I'm sure John will get it up on edutalk.cc very soon. It would be great if you have any comments or queries or questions, if you just go to edutalk.cc and leave a comment on the post with the audio, or of course you can get in touch via email or Twitter, and I'll make sure that if any of the questions are directed at Professor Townsend, that I will forward them on as soon as possible. So thank you very much to John and to Professor Tony Townsend for being part of the show tonight.
Thank you for inviting me, David, and let me also congratulate you. I think this is it's a wonderful opportunity for people to actually start a dialogue. So congratulations on doing this, and I wish you all the best.
Okay, thank you very much, and until next time, good night.
Cheers. Just thanks. Oop. We're gone. Okay, folks, thanks very much for listening. We're going to return to the random streaming of EduTalk Audio now. I'd just really like to thank Tony, because I think if I could take some of that advice, I'd be a better teacher straight away tomorrow. Cheers.